The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Michelle Bachmann is a U.S. congressional representative from Minnesota. Just recently, this energetic and articulate woman who calls herself a constitutional conservative announced that she's actively seeking to be the Republican Party candidate for the U.S. presidency. In this broadcast, I'm taking a closer look at her outlook, her views, as expressed in recent statements. I'm doing this not because I have any special regard for or dislike of Michelle Bachmann, but because she presents herself cogently and effectively, and more importantly, because her views are shared by many Americans, especially by those who call themselves conservatives, and because she echoes the outlook of many other prominent American political figures in both major parties. As I'll explain, Bachmann's views about America and about the character and history of this country and about the U.S. relationship with the rest of the world not only grossly distort historical reality, but they are dangerously misleading. I use the word carefully. I say they're dangerously misleading, especially during this time of national doubt and apprehension, a time that requires more than ever a candid and soberly realistic view of history and ourselves. More than that, Michelle Bachmann betrays the very principles she claims to uphold. A few weeks ago, Michelle Bachmann issued a video statement, which can easily be found online, in which she laid out her views about Israel and U.S. foreign policy. The U.S.-Israel alliance, she said, is not only critical for Israel, which is understandable, but she said that the U.S.-Israel alliance is critical for the United States as well. She said that she finds it shocking that President Obama has said that Israel would have to make peace with the Palestinians based on the 1967 borders. This would mean, she said, that Obama is telling Israel to, as she puts it, give up its right to defensible borders. Bachmann said that Obama's views are shared by only a tiny minority of Americans. She said, quote, most Americans recognize that Americans and Israelis are two sides of the same coin. Bachmann went on to say that we share the same exceptional mission to be a light to the nations. This is a point I'll go on to a little bit more, this notion of American exceptionalism. Bachmann, in this statement, went on to say that she was raised in a home full of love for Israel. She said that Israel is the greatest strategic asset of the United States in the Middle East. And she went on to insist that the U.S. must ensure that Israel stays strong, and even more, she went on, that Israel gets stronger. Now, it's hard to know where to begin exactly, but I'm going to highlight a few of these statements and take a look at it. First of all, Israel's not only security, but even Israel's existence is not critical for the United States of America. Israel's existence is no more critical for the United States of America than the existence of Bolivia, or the Philippines, or Burma, or many other countries around the world. If Israel were to disappear tomorrow, America's place in the world would change hardly at all. America got along fine for many, many, many years before Israel existed. And if Israel disappeared tomorrow, it would continue to operate and continue to function and do well or do just as well, perhaps even better. In fact, the claim that Israel is a strategic asset of the United States in the Middle East is exactly the opposite of the truth. Before Israel was founded as a state in 1948, America had no enemies in the Arab and Muslim world. In fact, of the major countries in the world, America was looked upon more favorably, more affectionately, than any of the other major countries. One of the reasons for that is that the United States, unlike France or Britain or Italy or Spain, had never had colonies in the Arab or Muslim world. Unlike the Soviet Union, the United States was not an atheistic country, and its political philosophy was not a one that most Arabs and Muslims rejected, as was the case with the Soviet Union. But America's relationship with Arab and Muslim countries has steadily deteriorated over the decades since the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. That's happened because in supporting the State of Israel, America, with each passing year, has had to, and as a consequence of that, has been supportive of policies of oppression, of aggression by Israel, betraying not only America's claimed principles, but countering the interests, not only of countries in the Middle East, but of Arab and Muslim countries everywhere, and even more than that, the American alliance with Israel has made a mockery of America's pretenses for democracy, for freedom, for representative government around the world. With each passing year, it's more and more obvious that despite what Michelle Bachmann and other American politicians say, the United States and Israel, on issue after issue, time and again, are virtually alone in the world. Now, Michelle Bachmann may regard this exceptionalism as a good thing, but as I'll explain in a minute, her idea of American exceptionalism is one that I am convinced the vast majority of Americans do not agree with and do not accept. Michelle Bachmann insists that the United States has to support Israel, must support it not only to be strong, but even stronger. What's the price that Michelle Bachmann and other American politicians who make such statements think that America should pay, the price that we should pay for this? How many American lives is Israel's security really worth? More than that, why is Israel's security more important than that of any other country in the region? For example, how important is Syria's security, or the security of the Palestinians, or the security of Lebanon, which Israel has violated numerous times? In the case of Syria, for example, since 1967, Israel has occupied part of that country in violation of international law. But for Michelle Bachmann and for those who express similar views about the U.S. relationship with Israel, her idea of security, her notions of security, exhibit a double standard that is a blatant one for most people around the world, one that has one level of idea of security for Israel and another for other countries. She says that she finds it shocking that President Obama should say that Israel should make peace based on the 1967 borders. Well, this statement by President Obama is nothing shocking or new at all. It's a reiteration of what has been officially the U.S. policy and position since 1967, when the Security Council of the United Nations passed Resolution 242, requiring Israel to withdraw from occupied territories to the 1967 borders. Under American and international law, Resolution 242 has the weight of law in the United States. In saying, as Michelle Bachmann does, that Israel should not be held to the 1967 borders is in effect to say that Israel should not be held to international law. But that's hardly unusual. Israel and its policies in many ways violates not only international law, but even American law. Israel is the one country in the Middle East that occupies territory of its neighbors, that has a nuclear weapons program in defiance of international law, and routinely violates Security Council United Nations resolutions. Israel has also a long record of even violating American law. But for Michelle Bachmann, that doesn't seem to matter. She also claims that the 1967 borders would mean that Israel would have to give up its rights to defensible borders. This is also a highly dubious, if not stupid, statement, because as the 1967 war and other wars have shown, Israel was not only able to defend those borders, it was able to take a territory from neighboring areas beyond those borders. Again, Israel's neighbors, immediate neighbors, include Lebanon in the north, which is a fractured country with no very strong military, the Palestinian Authority, which has no significant military presence. Those two nations are just simply dwarfed by Israel, which has nuclear weapons, a large air force, nuclear submarines provided by Germany. It's one of the most potent and mighty military forces in the world. To pretend that Israel, as Michelle Bachmann does, is some weak, defenseless country that has to be constantly propped up against dangerous neighbors is simply silly and ridiculous to not only objective people, objective observers of the Middle East scene, but around the world. They understand this. Now, she says that Obama's views are shared by only a tiny minority of Americans. Well, that may very well be true, because Americans have been conditioned through years of propaganda, years of distorted presentation of the situation in the U.S. media, in motion pictures and so forth, to give a totally convoluted and false impression of the background of the Israel-Palestine conflict, of the Israel-Middle East situation, and of the of Israel's place in the world. She says that most Americans recognize that Americans and Israelis are two sides of the same coin. Well, that's exactly the core of the problem. American Israelis are not two sides of the coin any more than any other country any other people are two sides of the same coin. Imagine if Michelle Bachmann were to claim that American and Mexicans are two sides of the same coin, or Americans and Argentines, or Germans, or Italians, or Russians. It would be regarded as simply silly. For her to claim that Americans and Israelis are, as she puts it, two sides of the same coin is simply a reflection of her own infatuation and of the propaganda that prevails here in this country. She went on to say that we, that is Americans, share the same exceptional mission to be a light to the nations. Well, I'm going to go into that in a little more in a few minutes. But that's another statement that expresses not the reality, but her infatuation, her wishful thinking, and the propaganda that prevails here in this country. Michelle Bachmann said, amazingly, that she was raised in a home full of love for Israel. Well, this is an extraordinary statement again. Imagine if an American political leader were to start a political campaign for the presidency by stating that he was raised in a home full of love for Kenya or for Japan. If an American political leader said that he was raised in a home full of love for Mexico or for Argentina, it would be regarded as either irrelevant or a dangerous expression of another loyalty. What Michelle Bachmann may mean by this is not merely love for a foreign country. What she means by this is love for the organized Jewish community here in the United States. But this, again, is extraordinary, because in supporting Israel and its policies, Michelle Bachmann is supporting a country that systematically, routinely regards Christians as second-class citizens of that country. Israel is built and based on premises very different than those that she says the United States was and should be based upon. Israel is an ethno-religious-based state. It's a Jewish state. It's a state that proclaims itself as the state of the Jewish people. America, as Michelle Bachmann and others remind us over and over, is not based on a particular ethnic or religious foundation or basis. It's based on a much broader one than that. But in saying that she's raised in a home full of love for Israel and insists on supporting Israeli interests and Israeli policies and Jewish interests and Jewish policies, she's giving support to policies of the Israeli government that oppress fellow Christians in the Middle East, in the Palestinian territories. In other words, Michelle Bachmann seems more concerned about Israel's security or the security of Jews in Israel and the Middle East than she is about her own people, her own ancestry, her own group. And an attitude like that is one that naturally is regarded with contempt by people around the world. It's either insincere or it's ridiculous. To say that Israel has to stay strong and get even stronger, one wonders how much stronger Israel can be. Because, after all, it's not only a formidable military power with a nuclear weapons arsenal that is illegal under international law in violation of standard rules that the United States insists upon for other countries, but it has the backing, of course, of the United States, American political leaders of both major parties constantly stressing that they guarantee and insist upon Israel's security as Israel defines it. Now, Michelle Bachmann's expressions of fervent, unquestioning support for Israel and the U.S. alliance with the Zionist state are not at all unusual. They reflect the prevailing outlook, as I mentioned, of the U.S. mass media and the outlook of the great majority of politicians of both of the major parties in the U.S. Congress. Now, more here is her perversion, her distortion of American history. Her view of American exceptionalism, what she calls American exceptionalism here, is not only historically inaccurate, it's the opposite of the truth. An authentic American conservative holds the view that the United States not only should not have a special relationship with Israel, it should not have a special relationship with any other country. That was, for many years, the standing and the generally accepted, widely accepted view of American foreign policy. This is expressed, for example, by President John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams was the sixth president of the United States. He was the son of the second president of the United States, John Adams. John Quincy Adams was born before the United States was even a country, and his family can therefore be considered, and should be considered, one of the founding families of American, of this country. John Quincy Adams also served in both the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives. But perhaps he's most distinguished as an American diplomat. He's widely regarded by historians at the time and into the present day as one of the great American diplomats. He served as Secretary of State of the United States and to help formulate the famous Monroe Doctrine. In 1821, as Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams issued a statement on a speech on U.S. foreign policy that's worth recalling, not merely because of its relevance to this talk here today, but because it's important to remember what, for many decades, was the prevailing and generally accepted view of Americans about U.S. foreign policy and our relationship with the rest of the world. To go back in history a little bit, when the United States was founded as a country, there were in the leadership of the U.S. government among leading Americans some people who were very sympathetic to Britain, who saw Britain as a kind of model or a country that the United States should be close to, and others who were very close and admiring of France. Thomas Jefferson, who had been a Secretary of State and a President of the United States, was a U.S. ambassador to France, and he had a strong affection for France. It was, after all, France's support of the United States during the Revolutionary War of Independence that made it possible for the United States to succeed in beating the British Empire and forming an independent country. The first U.S. ambassador to France was Benjamin Franklin, and he was also sympathetic to France. But there were others in the American government who were very sympathetic to Britain. But there was a general consensus, a general feeling, that regardless of whether one might be sympathetic to France or Britain or any other country, the policy of the United States, the exceptional policy of the United States, is not to be involved with the disputes and the passions and the wars and the struggles of foreign countries. For the founding fathers of America, American exceptionalism meant precisely that it stay out of the kinds of conflicts that prevailed in other countries, and especially in Europe. John Quincy Adams, in an address on U.S. foreign policy in 1821 as Secretary of State, he said this. He said, "The United States," he says, "has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when conflict has been for principles to which she clings, to which America clings." In other words, that the United States, even in conflicts overseas that might involve principles that we might be sympathetic to, the United States has and should stay out of such conflicts. He went on, "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will be her heart, her benediction, her prayers. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own." What John Quincy Adams was trying to stress is that no matter what cause or what struggle there may be of countries around the world, and how much we may wish for the success of one side or another, the only time the United States should be involved as a champion or vindicator, that is, with military force or taking actual action on the side, we should be only concerned about what's good for the United States of America. We should stay out of foreign conflicts, even if our sympathies might be with one country or another. John Quincy Adams went on, "She," that is America, "well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standards of freedom." He warned that if the United States becomes involved in foreign conflicts, becomes aligned with foreign countries, he went on, "she might become the dictatress of the world, a dictator. She would no longer be ruler of her own spirit." What John Quincy Adams was warning against is that an attachment and a support of foreign countries in foreign conflicts means a betrayal of the very spirit of America that he felt was very important. And this outlook of staying out of foreign conflicts has long been a hallmark, or was long a hallmark, of American foreign policy, and is exactly 100% diametrically the opposite of the outlook on foreign policy that Michelle Bachmann upholds and expresses in her statement about Israel. Even more to the point is the and a representative of the traditional American view of its foreign policy is the famous farewell address of President George Washington. George Washington laid out America's foreign policy principles in his famous farewell address, issued in 1796. This farewell address was for many years the touchstone, the founding stone of American foreign policy. But it's a articulation of the foreign policy that was the traditional conservative one, and even held by liberals in America, that Michelle Bachmann has distorted and has betrayed. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, Reason Radio Network.
Well, of all the server hosting contingency plans on the books, here's one that you probably missed: a web server takedown and a seizure by the FBI. Well, that's exactly what took place in Ruston, Virginia on Tuesday. FBI agents raided a data center in the wee hours of the morning, confiscating servers used by a number of companies, taking many sites offline. Now, it's kind of unclear what the federal agents were investigating at the moment, but folks say that it's an unprecedented move by the agency. Details, of course, are still murky, but let's see if our next guest can help us make sense of it all. Now, Declan McCullough is a correspondent at CNET News and joins us live now. Declan, what do we know about this raid so far?
Hi there. Unfortunately, we know not nearly as much as we'd like to know. The FBI seized not just a few computers, but entire racks of computers used as servers in this raid in Reston, Virginia. And it appears as though it was maybe a little overbroad. Like the FBI didn't quite understand how servers were configured. They took more than was necessary, and so then you had collateral damage. Some websites that were entirely innocent of any wrongdoing went offline as this collateral damage.
What were they looking for, the FBI?
Again, we don't know. The FBI isn't exactly putting out a press release yet. But as far as we can tell, it might have been related to some recent LulzSec hacking intrusion attempts. There have been efforts against Senate.gov last week. There's an arrest in the last 48 hours in Switzerland, for instance. And so that's what we think it is.
Well, the timing of the raid is somewhat interesting. You mentioned the LulzSec attack. Of course, this comes in the heels of the arrest of Ryan Cleary in the UK, who's associated with the group loosely. Do we have any other indication that this could be some sort of an effort by the FBI to investigate that group?
We have a few news reports saying that these on attributing this to government officials talking on background that, yes, the two are related, but we don't have any official information. Although I really kind of want to reserve judgment on the propriety of this until we actually have the court records and we see exactly what they were going after, it is a little worrisome that the raid seized all of these servers. There are other ways to do this. For instance, you just ask to copy all the data. I mean, it's like a printing press being used to publish libelous material. You seize the books. You don't seize the printing press that's used by maybe 100 other companies. So there's a little bit of a First Amendment issue, and that's the danger.
Well, that's a great analogy. And I'm just wondering, I mean, in your years of covering these kinds of issues, have you seen this kind of raid take place before?
There's only one incident that comes to mind, and that was that's approaching 20 years ago, and that's when the Secret Service raided a BBS bulletin board system of
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the views of Michelle Bachmann and how they differ from the authentically conservative views and actually long-standing views on U.S. foreign policy that American leaders held for many, many years, as were laid out by America's founding fathers. I cited the statement as Secretary of State by John Quincy Adams, who also served as President of the United States and whose father John Adams was the second president of the United States. John Quincy Adams and other founding fathers warned against a close attachment or close alliance with any foreign country, that America should always first and foremost put American interests first. This is one of the things that they meant by America as an exceptional country, that it should not be involved in the seemingly endless wars and conflicts that many other countries seemed, from the American perspective, to be involved with in Europe. Particularly, America's founding fathers wanted Americans to avoid the kind of endless wars that Britain and France had been involved with, even though there were many in the United States at the time who were sympathetic to one country or the other, to Britain or to France. Perhaps the best-known expression of this view of American foreign policy of the Founding Fathers was laid out in the well-known farewell address of George Washington of 1796. It's been widely cited and represents the view of America's relationship with other countries that was a hallmark of American foreign policy for many years, and especially of those who call themselves conservative. But that's not the view of Michelle Bachmann, or for that matter, of the leading politicians today in the United States of both major political parties, both Democrat and Republican. In his farewell address, George Washington made a number of very, very good and insightful points, but on the issue of foreign policy, he said, "Nothing is more essential than that permanent, inveterate antipathies against particular nations and passionate attachments for others should be excluded. America should avoid both permanent antipathy or hostility to other countries, and it should avoid passionate attachments to foreign countries." He went on, "In place of them, there should be just and amicable feelings towards all. Those feelings should be cultivated. The nation which indulges towards another a habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead us astray from its duty and its interest. Antipathy in one nation against another disposes each more readily to offer insult and injury, to lay hold of slight causes of umbrage, and to be haughty and intractable when accidental or trifling occasions of dispute occur." George Washington's point is is worth remembering today, that the habitual fondness that many American politicians show toward Israel has gotten us involved in disputes in a way that causes us to lose sight of the duty of American leaders to the American, to what is good for the United States, and to the authentic interests of the American people. Washington went on. He said, "A passionate attachment of one nation for another produces a variety of evils. Sympathy for the favorite nation, facilitating the illusion of an imaginary common interest in cases where no real common interest exists, and infusing into one the enmities of the other, betrays the former into a participation in the quarrels and wars of the latter without adequate inducement or justification." What he means here is that a passionate attachment in the modern context to Israel or any other country, special sympathy for a favorite nation, creates the illusion that there is a real interest when, in fact, no such real interest really exists, and makes the United States, in this case, become involved and embroiled in conflicts and quarrels that Israel may find itself in without really adequate justification for America or the American people. Washington went on. "Such a passionate attachment," he said, "gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who devote themselves to the favorite nation facility to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country without odium, sometimes even with popularity, gilding with the appearance of a virtuous sense of obligation, a commendable deference for public opinion, or a laudable zeal for public good, the base or foolish compliances of ambition, corruption, or infatuation. This is particularly relevant to what Michelle Bachmann has said about the U.S. relationship with Israel. She seems to be, or gives the impression, that she's expressing the opinion of the American people, that she's going along with the popular view in this country. But in fact, this is only a cover, only a pretext, in her case and in the case of many other American politicians, for what Washington warned about the ambitious or corrupted or deluded views of these people. Now, I don't claim to know if Michelle Bachmann is sincere in her ardent support and her stated love of Israel, whether it's merely a reflection of ambition because she wants to be elected president of the United States, or that she's been corrupted in some way, or that she's merely deluded, that is, that she may be sincere in this, sincere in her views. But whatever the reason, this is, as Washington warned, this is a base or foolish compliance that covers ambition, corruption, or infatuation. Washington went on, as avenues to foreign influence in innumerable ways, such attachments are particularly alarming to the truly enlightened and independent patriot. How many opportunities do they afford to tamper with domestic factions, to practice the arts of seduction, to mislead public opinion, to influence or awe the public councils? Well, this is also, once again, very relevant to the pro-Israel attitude and policies of American politicians today, who have allowed themselves to be seduced or corrupted by a foreign interest, a foreign influence, namely that of Israel or of the world Jewish community. And Washington warns that the truly enlightened and independent patriot, that is, the person who is aware of what is the authentic good of the United States and the American people in this way, will avoid and should shun these kinds of passionate attachments. Washington went on to say, quote, "Against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, I conjure you to believe me, fellow citizens, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake, since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of Republican government." These, again, are words well worth remembering. He urges fellow Americans to be, as he puts it, constantly awake against the insidious influence of foreign influence. Finally, George Washington says, "The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is in extending our commercial relations to have with them as little political connection as possible." These words ought to be underlined, especially when one hears American politicians talk, as Michelle Bachmann and others do, about how America's relationship with Israel is critical for the United States. As I mentioned before, America was a prosperous country, was able to get along quite well before Israel was even founded as a state in 1948, and it would be prosperous and able to function very well in the world if Israel disappeared tomorrow, in much the same way that many other countries have vanished from the map, vanished from history, but America has continued, even though various countries that once existed no longer exist. More than that, Michelle Bachmann's presentation of Israeli history and the nature of the Israeli state is very wrong. She suggests over and over that Israel should be supported because it's an exceptional country, a so-called light unto the nations, just like the United States of America. Well, if there's any pretense that has proven barren and untrue, it's Israel's pretense to be a light unto the nations. When Israel was established in May of 1948, its leaders told the world that they were founding a country which, at long last, Jews would live in peace and security, that the country would be self-sufficient, a self-sufficient nation where Jews would prosper on the basis of their own labor, abilities, and efforts. Israel's leaders declared that they were creating a society in which Jews would finally live as a normal people in a country of their own. Well, although Israel can cite some impressive achievements since its founding in 1948, the Zionist state has spectacularly failed to achieve its central proclaimed goals. Far from being a beacon of morality, it has deservedly earned a global reputation as an oppressive, self-righteous, arrogant, and belligerent state. Israel was founded on terrorism, massacres, ethnic cleansing, and the dispossession of its native Palestinian population. Even now, it violates international law, inflicts a harsh collective punishment on the civilian populations under its control, continues to deny Palestinians their human and national rights. In accord with its Jewish supremacist ideology, Israel's discrimination against non-Jews is systematic and institutional. It's the only country in the region that occupies territory of its neighbors, that refuses to define its borders, and which possesses a large and illegal arsenal of nuclear weapons. Israel has never been self-supporting. It's always required massive subsidies from the outside, above all from the United States, from American taxpayers. In addition to direct U.S. aid to Israel, which has amounted to well over $140 billion, Israel has also received important money in restitution from Germany and other European states, and from wealthy Jewish communities, especially in the United States, have provided substantial financial independence. Now, a look at the real history of the founding of the State of Israel and the U.S. relationship with Israel when it was founded in 1948 shows that Michelle Bachmann's claim that the U.S. Relationship is critical for the United States and useful as a strategic asset to the United States is entirely untrue. President Harry Truman gave U.S. diplomatic relationship recognition to the new Israeli state immediately following its proclamation in May 1948. But when he did so, he did it rejecting the advice of nearly every American official who was responsible for U.S. foreign policy. The Secretary of State at the time, George C. Marshall, angrily told Truman that recognizing Israel would mean putting partisan political interests above America's national interest. Roy Henderson, who was head of the U.S. State Department's Bureau for Middle Eastern Affairs, warned President Truman that U.S. backing for the new Zionist state would be, as he put it, contrary to the interests of the United States and will eventually involve us in international difficulties of so grave a character that the reaction throughout the world, as well as in this country, will be very strong. Henderson went on to warn that Zionists ignored such principles as self-determination and majority rule, and instead, he warned, Zionists embraced the principle of a theocratic racial state. He also warned that the establishment of a U.S.-backed Zionist state, in his words, would guarantee that the Palestine problem would be permanent and still more complicated in the future. Every one of the warnings and predictions made by Loy Henderson the top U.S. official responsible for Middle East policy turned out to be vindicated by events, turned out to be true. Contrary to the claims made by Michelle Bachmann and American and other American political leaders, and of course Israeli political leaders, U.S. support for Israel has never been in America's authentic national interest, nor has it been based on a commitment to democracy and freedom. Just as perceptive Washington officials foresaw in 1948, America's pro-Israel policy has proved terribly costly to the United States in wasted billions of dollars, in lost international credibility and standing, and in lives squandered for the interests of a foreign state. As great as the price that America has paid for its special relationship with Israel, its what Bachmann calls exceptional relationship with Israel, this price will undoubtedly grow in the years ahead. More to the point, Michelle Bachmann's ardent support for Israel, her claimed love of Israel, is more than anything else an expression of Jewish Zionist power here in the United States. It's an indisputable fact that America's wealthy and well-organized Jewish community wields tremendous influence through its important role in the media, in political and cultural life, and more directly, through massive donations to the election campaigns of politicians of both major political parties. That's one of the reasons why just recently the Forward newspaper, probably the most best-informed and best-written Jewish community weekly, published an article talking about how Michelle Bachmann seems to be making a focused appeal for Jewish support in her bid for the presidency of the United States. The Forward points out that Michelle Bachmann, along with other so-called Tea Party personalities, including Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck, have been stressing their ardent support for Israel. Of course, this isn't at all confined to those who identify with the Tea Party movement. Mitt Romney, Huckabee, and other Republican candidates for the presidency have also begun and strengthened their campaign for the presidency with visits to Israel, less because they support Israel than to secure their base of secure a strong base of support among the all-important American organized American Jewish community. As any number of analysts have emphasized, something like 60% of campaign election funds for Democratic Party candidates for the presidency have come from wealthy of Jewish donors, and maybe 20, 30, 40% have come from Jewish donors for Republican nominees, for Republican presidential candidates. Another way to put it is that no single ethnic religious group in the United States wields more political clout and power than the organized Jewish community of this country. And that is an important reason why Michelle Bachmann explanation of why she is making such a concerted, focused appeal for Jewish support in her candidacy for the presidency of the United States. But as George Washington emphasized, those Americans who are, as he puts it, enlightened and independent patriots, independent thinking patriots, should see through this. That those people who are supportive of a foreign country, who in fact are putting the interests of Israel or the organized Jewish community even above authentic American interests, this is dangerous for America and shows a lack of understanding or a deliberate perversion of the authentic interests and character of the United States of America. Michelle Bachmann stresses her Christian affiliations and backgrounds, but In her ardent support for Israel, and this is true of others like her, she shows that she supports, in fact, oppression by the Israeli state, dispossession and oppression of fellow Christians who live among Israel's Palestinian population or in the occupied territories occupied by Israel. Most of the world understands this. Most of the world sees through this. That's why time and time again in the United Nations and in other international forums, the United States and Israel are time and again alone in trying to justify or support Israeli policies that the rest of the world understands and sees as oppressive, illegal, and unjust. The U.S. relationship with Israel that Michelle Bachmann and other leading Democratic and Republican leaders support betrays not merely the principles that these politicians claim to uphold, it makes it increasingly difficult for the United States to be a credible player in the world, because U.S. support for Israel and this policy of support for Israel makes a mockery of the standards that the United States tries to uphold and makes it very difficult for America to have any credibility when it calls for policies anywhere. What it means is, as most foreigners conclude and most countries conclude, is that what really is the basis of American foreign policy is not even what's good for the United States. It's based upon who has political power and clout in the American domestic scene. As I've said on many occasions, the decision by President Truman to recognize Israel in 1948 and to support the Zionist cause in Palestine was an expression not of the authentic interests of the United States, but rather an expression of the tremendous power already in 1948 that the organized Jewish community, the pro-Israel lobby, already had in this country. But Michelle Bachmann, we'll be hearing, I'm sure, much more about her in the months ahead as the campaign for the presidency gathers momentum, especially among Republicans, and as various Republican candidates compete with each other for popular support. But every American who is concerned about what is best for the world, what is authentically best for America, who regards himself as sincere in his support for principles, either liberal or conservative principles, should understand and see through this kind of fuzzy, self-serving support for the U.S. For the U.S. relationship with Israel, personified by the campaign of Michelle Bachmann and other leading American politicians. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Please check out the website of the Institute for Historical Review, IHR.org, and we welcome questions or comments. Write to me at weber@ihr.org or contact us through the contact page of the IHR website.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.